Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Hi folks, welcome to the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters, episode 77, the final part of William the Conqueror. So he has, of course, grown up in the rough back streets of Normandy. He has conquered England, and he is trying to settle the place. But we've still got quite a way to go, haven't we?
Yeah.
Turns out there are lots of revolts.
We got up to about, well, we got up to the Harrying of the North, didn't we? Which is sort of 1069 over to 1070. Yes,
the Northern Genocide.
And we talked a bit about a couple of lines from the accounts at the time, which was about the best evidence you can get. So moving on from that, because of course that casts a shadow over the rest of the reign. I think I mentioned it last time, but I'll say it again, and I'll go into detail when we get to the end of this one. But there were just two great crimes among many of his life. And one was the Battle of Hastings, which seems to have been unusually bloody, even for the 11th century. And then the harrying of the North. Because even contemporaries, some contemporaries, again, even for the 11th century, were like, that's bad.
Which, as we have covered, was a rough century.
But we'll get to that. But that's sort of just in the background. That's sort of just played out. He does, it's around 1070, it was in 1070 that he commissions Battle Abbey, which is that abbey built on, apparently on the site of the Battle of Hastings. He has a second coronation in 1070.
Well, does he?
Because if you remember, his original one was something of a damp squib. Well, that's not the right way of putting it. It was a weird, broken up, dodgy coronation.
Highly tense, punctuated with the odd massacre.
A little bit of a massacre. So he wanted a nice one that was going to go down smoothly. And so that's what he did. And one of the things to mention is, of course, he gets completely kitted out in his full regalia, crown and full regalia. He does that a lot. I'll mention it again a bit later, but he quite often cracks out the full royal regalia and wears his crown around the court for days on end and things, which not many kings do.
I suppose if your position feels insecure, then perhaps you would think, you know, I'm going to dress like the king today, just so everyone knows, just to really cement it in their minds.
It does speak of a little bit of insecurity,
doesn't
it?
Yes, it does.
Because, yeah, like our queen, say, the actual full royal, the coronation crown, the one with the massive diamond in it. She never cracked that out whenever
it's
she wanted.
Really heavy.
It's, yeah, and it's completely ceremonial. It's sort of kept in the Tower of London most of the time.
But then her legitimacy of reign was never in question.
Right, exactly, Well, of course, But all these sorts of things, you don't just, not just in the 11th century, but in, even in the 11th century, I mean, you wouldn't do that much, but he seems to like it. the Pope sends over two cardinals to sort of oversee this second coronation. And we're going to talk a little bit in this epoch all about the relationship with Rome and how the Pope Alexander he died and another one came in, a Gregory, and they're very different popes. And William had always had a great relationship with Alexander.
Who's endorsed
was it
by
Alexander the Second and Gregory the Seventh? If I get that wrong, I'll put text up on the screen correcting myself. So they're very different, and where he had really super, super tight bro relationship with Alexander. When he dies and the next one comes in, it's much more strained. They're kind of on the same page, and William's not in any danger of being excommunicated or anything like that, but it's a whole different relationship, and you can't just formally count on the Pope on Rome at all times, just to have his back at all times. This new Pope, Gregory, himself is a bit of a failure. He gets himself deposed in the end. He's just a bit more of a difficult character.
Right, okay.
But there you go. It's in 1070 that William finally, just while we're on the theme of the church and ecclesiastical matters, he decides he's going to get rid of Stigand, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was fully Anglo-Saxon. He'd been the Archbishop for many, many years, decades.
Yeah.
He's an old hat. He was Harold Godwinson's pick.
Yeah.
He was sort of dyed-in-the-wool Anglo-Saxon. It's surprising he didn't remove him straight away, but then...
You can tell with a name like Stigand... Mm-hmm. It's not very French.
Exactly. And different archbishops over the centuries have different degrees of how willing they are to dissent from Rome and or the crown. Mm. Some are just do completely as they're told. And others dig their heels in and won't do anything they're told. Mm. Who's the Henry II's famous archbishop who... What's his name? Thomas Becket.
Yeah.
So Thomas Becket was just a real pain in the king's behind.
Meddlesome priest, I hear.
Yeah, yeah. Almost going out of his way to be difficult, it seems. We'll get to that when we come up to Henry II. But so, Stigand, although was, you know, bent the knee and all that sort of thing, he was still not ideal. Hmm. He was still not ideal. And where his career had started, been around since like the 1020s, William the Conqueror had hoped that in 1066 he would die soon. But 4 years later, he's still around, still going strong. So it seems like William the Conqueror just ran out of patience.
Just sick of old man Stigand.
Yeah, yeah, that he's an embarrassment. And that. So one thing to mention, I don't want to go into this too much because time is obviously a premium. Hmm. But there's this thing they called the Reformed Church. All through the 11th century, loads of seismic things are going on in Rome within the Catholic Church. Hmm. The Great Schism. But more than, there's all sorts of different things going on. But anyway... The last pope I talked about, Alexander II, he was what they call, he's part of the Reformed Church or Reformed Catholicism. And all that really means, because of course you can get it mixed up with the Reformation, which is hundreds and hundreds of years later in the age of Luther and things. Nevertheless, there was sort of a Reformed, they called it a Reformed Church. And the Normans were completely on board with that project. And just broadly speaking, roughly speaking, among the main things that that's about is revering saints, especially local saints, less, putting more emphasis on Christ himself.
Did always have that kind of pagan taste to it, didn't it? You know, I'll pray to these saints for intercession with Jesus or God, who are the same. And it's like, yeah, this is starting to sound more like polytheism.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so the English apparently had or did have a very, very long, complicated tradition, this is in the 11th century still, of revering specifically English saints. St. Dunstan is the most famous one, but there was loads of them, dozens of them.
What a shock.
Yeah. And so, like, so in the 8th and 9th century, we just had dozens of different bishops and archbishops got canonised into saints, and we then revered their bones and their bodies.
And you might pray to them if you had a severe case of gout, like it was Asclepius or something, you know? And it's like, I'm feeling very pagan. I can understand why they're upset about it.
The sort of more centralised Roman church was just simply, this won't do, especially when they knew what the lives of these quote-unquote saints were like. Mm. They were quite often... you know, get into brawls with Vikings and things. They're not particularly saintly.
Sound pretty base, though.
Well, yeah. Yeah. What we used to do, apparently, is have saints' bones in sort of receptacles that sat either side of the altar inside the church, in the middle of the church, that sat either side of the altar.
This is sounding deeply pagan.
Right. So the Pope and various...
the Pope can shut up. I'm liking this.
Various cardinals they sent over are like, what's this about? This is weird. We don't like this.
How Christianity works over here. Just accept it.
Right. Well, the opposite happens, that we're forced to do away with it. So what happens is, when Stigand is finally removed...
And there were the seeds of Brexit. I can feel it.
Yeah. We want to do things our own way.
Yeah.
Just let us do it our own way.
Yeah. Is that too much to ask?
According to Rome, that's far too much.
Yeah.
So he's replaced with someone I mentioned, Lanfranc. I won't attempt the French, Lanfranc, but it's Lanfranc.
Yeah.
And he had been just quite a famous intellectual theologian in French theologian, and had been made, William had made him like a bishop or an archbishop in France, in sort of Caen, a monastery in Cayenne. And And so when it's sort of his obvious choice to make Lanfranc the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he had to sort of cajole him, almost bully him into being a bishop in Normandy. Hmm. So here, apparently Lanfranc just completely refuses for quite a while, months.
Really? Why?
Which is a dangerous thing to do. And obviously, well, because it's a massive responsibility. You become responsible for the souls of millions of people.
It's also a really political office, sure.
Yeah, massively, hugely. So, yeah.
Going to get a lot of enemies out of that.
And so in the end, the Pope, it would still be Alexander at this point, gets in Lanfranc's ear and says, no, you've got to do it, though. Come on, you've got to. And so, well, he does. In fact, while I'm on here, I was going to leave it for a little bit later, but there's a few good lines where Lanfranc, because I say we've got his letters, haven't we? Mm. So I've scrolled past it. Oh, yeah. So Lanfranc, because he wrote loads of letters to this Pope, and most of them survive in the Vatican and things. And he wrote, when I was in charge of the monastery at Cayenne, I was unequal to ruling a few monks. So I cannot conceive by what judgment of Almighty God I have at your insistence been made the overseer of many and numberless peoples.
I quite like the humility of it, actually.
Yeah. He seems, because we get into some rulers in a minute about Odo of Bayeux, who's a psychopath, really.
Yeah.
Something like that. Whereas Lanfranc isn't. He's ruthless sometimes, but he's not a complete psychopath by any means whatsoever. So just to finish up, if I could just sort of maybe finish up on the ecclesiastical side of things so we can get more into the secular men. One thing that is seismic, though, it seems, without overdoing it too much, is what the reform of the church is. So with the exception of Westminster Abbey, every great abbey, there's something like 15 cathedrals, Anglo-Saxon cathedrals in England at this time. By the time of William the Conqueror's son's death, around 1100, there wasn't one standing. They'd all been knocked down and rebuilt in the Norman fashion, in the Romanesque style. All
right, okay. That's a shame.
Yeah.
I bet some of them were lovely.
Yeah, yeah. And nearly all the senior clergy, there's like one archbishop left by the time of the death of William the Conqueror that was Anglo-Saxon. And as I mentioned, I think in the other one, he was a complete quizzling type.
Yeah.
They've all been replaced.
Virtually a total replacement of the ruling class of the church.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And it was a bit slowly. It took years. It wasn't just one sweep.
Sure.
But that is what happened.
Continuous process, those.
And they stopped English being spoken. It had to be done, because that's funny, isn't it? In the Reformation days of Luther, you get the impression that the liturgy had always been in Latin. No?
It used to be in English.
Right.
Alfred the Great translated the Bible into English, English, Anglo-Saxon English.
Yeah.
So everyone could read it.
So Tyndale was the first one to translate into English. Nope.
No, he was a thousand years ahead of his time. Alfred was a really forward-thinking man, actually, you know. But it, again, just makes you think that England was somewhere slightly different, right? It's like a much more sort of small, parochial, homely place. You know, that's always how it felt. It's like, well, the king obviously translated into English so everyone could learn how to be a good Christian. I mean, that was literally his motivation. It's like, but that's not how that works everywhere else. You know, that's how it worked here, though, which is nice, isn't it?
Yeah. And one of the things that gets said a lot is from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle and other things, people that lived through it. Mm. You know, it doesn't really matter particularly too much if you're some rural peasant who the king is necessarily. If his policies don't touch you and your village, you might not even know. But the thing that everyone realised and knew is that their church has changed or been knocked down and rebuilt.
Yeah.
Or that all this, if failing that, all the saintly relics had been done away with. So, yeah, they hated
I can imagine.
The French reformed Christians, hate Norman ones, hated this.
Tammy, that's Brexit right there. That's the seed of it right there. I can see it. I can just feel it. I feel the anger. One day in 1,000 years' time, we're going to get our revenge on you.
So either all these saints' bones were either just stowed away somewhere, literally put out in an attic somewhere, or actually destroyed. So there's a few examples when some of these new bishops and archbishops said, well, if they're real relics, then they will stand up to an ordeal by fire then, won't they? Let's burn them all, see what happens. If they're real, they'll be fine.
Let's try that with a piece of the true cross, shall we?
All right. It's impervious to flame, apparently.
Yeah, obviously not.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, and one last thing just to mention on that is that some of the churches, big, like the big ones, like Winchester was a few others, Ely, they were on a giant scale. the Norman, these earliest Norman, we've got bigger ones a bit later. But even the earliest ones, like at Winchester, they were the biggest things in Europe, save St. Peter's in Rome.
Hmm.
There's like a few big ones that Germans had built. But yeah, like they rebuilt, William builds a huge one at Winchester, for example. And they're just giant, like a couple hundred feet across and stuff.
Again, imperial statements. This is what this is.
Exactly that.
A new culture is here. There are castles, there are these massive foreign churches. You know, the remnants of the old religion is being taken out, even though it's apparently the same. Yes.
Yeah, it seems, well, it was definitely the case, and they were aware of it at the time very consciously. We want to emulate ancient empires. We absolutely want to outdo, like at a glance, outdo the Anglo-Saxon or the Viking attempts at empire, if you like. We're going to, there's going to be no doubt in anyone's mind that when you walk into one of our cathedrals, you realise you're just a tiny speck, you're a little nothing.
This is radicalising me against the Normans, you
know. Yeah, I get it. I get it. Because when we get to the end, I'll do a sum up and... Yeah. It's just, it's really, really brutal. We haven't even talked a great deal about the murder and rape and theft.
No.
Not really. I mean, how much can you go on and on and on about the same topic? But there's loads of it.
Yep.
Okay. So let's see. Let's get into the revolt of Ely. This is the big one. Okay. After the harrying of the north, then there was loads of revolts up north. There was one in Ely, and as I mentioned, I think in the last one, Ely now is just a town.
Yeah.
But it used to be really an island. It was like surrounded by very almost unpassable marshes and bogs, and so there was sort of really an island, the Isle of Ely, with a big cathedral on it and things. Okay. And it was sort of a perfect spot to a defensive spot. And where it's in the Fens in East Anglia, it's sort of one of the hotbeds of rebellion anyway. So it's just not surprising that a rebellion happened around there.
Hmm.
And Hereward the Wake is involved in this one. So this is where he finally comes in.
This is the legendary Hereward the Wake.
Anyone who's never heard that name and might not know, he's just a famous, famous English rebel who sort of just
pretty
refused.
Pretty much a proto Robin Hood as well in many ways, right? Because the Wake means the watcher, doesn't it?
Or that he's just difficult to outwit.
So is he leading the revolt?
He's one of the leaders. Right. So here we have Eadwine and Morcar come back on the scene.
Absolute clowns. Yeah. Oh, good. You're back, are you?
And
you like bad luck charms.
And it seems that it does say everything they touch turns to crap. And so the historians, because this is all, you get the odd line here and there in the chronicle and things, they're like, well, where have they? Oh, they're suddenly back, aren't they? What happened? Because they were obviously arrested or in custody after 1066. And we see them definitely being taken back to Normandy at some point as guests, in inverted commas, stroke hostages. But they are now in 1070, 1071. Back in England, sort of at large. And it seems that what it was, William allowed them to remain as nominally Earls of Mercia in Northumbria. But of course, no power whatsoever. It would have been laughable to actually call them an earl still. But he allowed them their liberty to move around essentially freely.
That seems dangerous. These guys must have been really incompetent. But they come to William and William's just like, well, these aren't leading a rebellion, these are useless. Go on, earls. Go enjoy yourselves. William must have just been like, no, these are totally unimpressive men.
And if the worst comes to the worst, my cavalry will just ride them down.
Exactly.
I don't mind doing that. That's fine, that's what I do, that's how I roll.
Maybe it'll be a good example to the rest.
I almost dare you to do something because, so we find that they're sort of at large. And when another rebellion starts around Ely, it seems like most people that are still can rally to it. So Eadwine and Morcar go there, and Edgar the Aetheling is there. There's another important guy, Walthinoth. There's a Roger, Earl of Chester. I believe there's a few people that are sort of still outstanding.
Isn't Roger a French name?
Yeah. We've got Rogers on both sides here.
Oh, right, okay.
You said before that there was a guy, what was it? Not Fitzpatrick. There's another one I mentioned last time, where it's quite a French-sounding name, but he was an English partisan. He was an Anglo-Saxon, but you were quite right to say, well, that sounds French. It's like,
Complex world.
Actually, I've got a quick line there while we're on names. There's one bit where a load of the people, a lot of Anglo-Saxon names were mentioned when Matilda came over and William got her coronated. Hmm. And what people like to do is we've got Doomsday Book and we've got the names of all the people that are involved in 1086. They reference it back to the last great list they had where loads and loads of people turned up. Everyone that's important really turned up. And it was the coronation of Matilda like 15 odd years earlier. Mm. And there's lots of English names that were present there still. And they're sort of all gone by the time of Doomsday Book.
So they've either been killed or disinherited.
Right. Yeah, one way or another. Let me just find, because they are some quite funny names. Classic Anglo-Saxon names are things like Ethelhead, Tovey, Dinny, Ethelgeard, Bondig, Wolfweird, Herding, Briggsy, Bridrig.
Briggsy sounds good.
Right, yeah.
Oi, Briggsy.
Yeah.
Gonna go fight some Normans, isn't it?
Right. So people with names like that, by 1086, Doomsday Book, are gone.
Yeah,
there's none of them. The upper echelons of sort of levels of earldom or lower, there's none.
Mm.
And you have to go down to sort of the third tier of landowners, people whose land yielded like £1 a year, which is still not nothing, but quite
smallholder.
You're not a complete peasant, but smallholder, because you're a subtenant.
Yeah,
and even then. There used to be thousands of those guys, 4,000 or 5,000 of those, and now there's hardly any. So you can see that even though it wasn't done overnight, like 1016, given enough years, it was thoroughly done.
But even then, it's only like a decade, you know. And for the last, 400 years, these people's lives and social arrangements basically hadn't changed, you know. And so suddenly in a decade, it's all different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's literally like Tony Blair taking over.
Mm. Kind of seismic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard not to say it's sort of seismic. Okay, just to get back to the revolt at Ely.
Mm.
So when Edwine and Morcar sort of declare that they have to make a break from William's sort of very, very loose house arrest or something. They make a break for him, formally declare that they're for this rebellion. And basically no one, hardly anyone, rallies to their calls, their banner. Mm. And it's because, as we mentioned, where have you been the last couple of years? You're supposed to be protecting us. Where were you in October 1066?
Yeah.
You didn't turn up. Like, yeah, no, we've lost all faith in you.
Unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who would have thought that, seen that coming? You know, yeah, of course they've lost faith in you.
Yeah.
We're told that particularly Edwine was sort of aimlessly, that's the quote, aimlessly just mooching around the country. And when this thing happened, he's like, right, well, this is my one, if slim, chance to try and do something, try and redeem myself on some level.
All right, wastrel.
God. Yeah. But William, in the end, turns up. This is in 1071 now.
Yeah.
And he puts down this rebellion. We don't have it in great detail, which I shall keep saying.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like he put it down within a matter of weeks or months, certainly within that year. And we're told that he may well have... it's annoying that you still have to say may or may not have, but he may well have built massive pontoon bridges to get across this marsh. And I always think that's great when there's a giant pontoon bridge built across the Bosphorus or built across the Danube or something when this happens.
Yeah.
Like, I would like to have seen that.
Yeah.
There's a bit in Henry II when they build bridge across to Anglesey in North Wales.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to have seen that.
Of these sort of like great military escapades would have been really entertaining to watch, if nothing else. Just like, go on then, you know, let's see how it works.
The psychology, how demoralising it must be from the other side. You're inside being besieged.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're watching this army just slowly build. No,
the best one has to be Tyre, right?
Oh, Alexander
at Tyre. Yeah. He's not even going to build a pontoon bridge. I'm just going to fill in the sea. Now it's a peninsula. You know, well, that must have been really depressing.
There's like nothing you can do to stop them. You just have to watch day after day. They're inching closer.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. gives me a cold shiver just thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So eventually, when he gets inside, we're told that possibly he did his old thing of promising the world to everyone. You will all be pardoned. Oh, yeah. Da, 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 da.
Heard this before.
And some he does, some he doesn't. Again, it seems quite clearly a clear-cut thing. If you're of noble birth, you get imprisoned and dispossessed at worst. If you're not of noble blood, you're going to be blinded and your hands and feet cut off and or just executed. But nevertheless, having said that, that's still clement for the 11th century.
It could be worse, yeah.
The Vikings killed everyone.
Yeah.
The Vikings just killed everyone, usually. Mm. Not always. I'm exaggerating a bit.
And you may have been tortured for months. You know, it could have been a lot worse if you just killed.
And the Angles and the Saxons. Mm. If they take over a village, yeah, the chieftain is going to be executed. Yeah. Absolutely, no question about that. Mm. But that's not really how the conqueror does things.
It's interesting how the noble birth, I mean, it seems obvious to anyone who knows anything about the Middle Ages, but it is a pattern you see played out over and over. I mean, it's something like, you know, the Battle of Agincourt and stuff like this. You know, it's always capturing the nobles, right? Because they're valuable and they're worth something. And that's the great humiliation of being captured by a bunch of English peasants.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like, I imagine that it would have been something very similar to what racism was in the South, right, in America. It would have been something quite similar to that.
In what way?
As in, the nobles would have always had this kind of social privilege, no matter where they are and what they're doing. They're always going to have this kind of superiority over the peasants. You know, even if they're not doing anything of any note, you know, it's always going to be, oh, he's a noble. Oh, well, I'm not a bloody noble, you know, better watch out, you know. There's always going to be that sort of dimension, I think.
Yeah, and particularly the Normans, they get mentioned in the sources and things. They quite often says things like they were men of overweening pride, or they were filled with pride. Mm. And that, yeah, but even the Anglo-Saxon nobility and things. Yeah, it's what the various stratas of society are made up of. If people don't respect it, then the whole thing can fall apart.
So William captures Edwin and Morcar and is like, you guys are too useless to execute.
Well, no, so he captures Morcar and he puts Morcar in prison for the rest of his life. And Morcar
safest
outlives,
place for him.
He outlives William the Conqueror.
The safest place for him. Yeah. Morcar clearly doesn't know what he wants, what he's doing. Yeah. What am I going to do? Wander around mooching off people? Put me in prison.
Yeah.
Got no respect for Morcar.
No, me neither. And he turns up a couple of times, or mentioned a couple of times. Like I say, he outlives the Conqueror himself.
Yeah.
But Edwine is, we're not sure exactly, but something else happened to him. Seems, well, he escaped. Loads of people escaped somehow from Ely, sort of at the last minute or something, including Hereward. In fact, that's one of the things the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle says, that Hereward the Wake led out a sortie to escape.
Right, okay.
Successfully.
Right, so they fought their way out.
Yeah, yeah. At least some small contingent fought their way out. Because Hereward the Wake, just to say a quick line on him, and most of what was written about him is a little bit like a Robin Hood figure or William Wallace, in the sense that, or much more like William Wallace than Robin Hood, because he's definitely real. There's no real doubt that he was a real historical figure, but yet all the detail, anything he was supposed to have said, has been made up later.
Yeah.
So like William Wallace in that sense. He's definitely a real figure, but any real detail was made up a long, long time later by people who certainly couldn't have known.
Yeah.
And so that's what we get with Hereward the Wake. There's loads and loads of mythology, for want of a better word, made up about him generations after, where he was like really mad, like a giant almost, and he's unstoppable. Wow. And he
why
was,
not?
Yeah, why not? And
prove he wasn't.
And he rescued damsels in towers. And,
of course he did.
Yeah, they slew witches and monsters. Yep. There's lots of monsters that Hereward killed.
Just not Normans, that's all.
Right, yeah. But we in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, it does say, there's a line that just says he led them out valiantly or something. So
probably a sorting
point
out
to that
to break out. Yeah.
Now, Edwine gets away, but not for long. And it seems like he is either makes it to Scotland or somewhere before he gets to Scotland, he is captured and killed, sort of en route somewhere. It's like a really ignominious death. Some say he turned round and fought a small engagement with some Norman warriors and was felled in that. But either way, he's dead.
I doubt it.
Yeah, yeah, I doubt that as well, yeah. So that's the end of Eadwine anyway. Edgar the Aetherling escapes to Scotland, all the way to Scotland. Mm. And of course he is, well, he's sort of William's main legit rival for the throne, right? But he's unlucky in war. He never seems to catch a break.
And the Scottish king is firmly under the thumb of William, surely?
Well, yes and no. Nominally, yes. He's supposed to be yes. But like any good Scottish monarch will do anything to screw over England at all times. So he's happy just to break his word and go back on his word.
Right, okay.
To house the Aetherling when he turns up. Well, let's just get straight into the next thing. I'd like to spend more time on the Siege of Ely, but William realises once he's put down, that is sort of, as well, they wouldn't have known this at the time, obviously, but we can now see that rebellion, or sometimes called the Earl's Rebellion, at Ely, was the last big English rebellion. It wasn't the last one at all, but it was the last massive one where, realistically, it could have worked. It might have worked. If things had gone
any... Do we have any indication of the size of the rebellion? How many men they managed to gather?
Not really. Thousands. It would be a few thousand,
though. Right. So it's significant to William.
Yeah.
Probably doesn't have that many more men than a few thousand.
Yeah. It's easy enough to say, isn't it, when you know history, that things were just always meant to be.
Yeah.
But that's not how it is it? That's not the reality of it. This is certainly a serious rebellion that could have been successful, possibly. Mm. If William had been unlucky or not played his cards correctly, he could have gone way worse. But he ends up sort of besting it in the end.
Well, one of the things you notice with William and all of these rebellions is that he takes the initiative, right? These rebellions never seem to take the initiative. We're in revolt. Now we're going to sit in Exeter. Now we're going to sit in Ely. So, okay, that's not going to conquer William.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to come to you and then beat you up.
Yeah. Yeah. He's coming for you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what he does.
Yeah, you should be out in the countryside making it, like, basically like Mao, actually, making it so he's afraid to leave the cities. You know, that's exactly what you should have been doing, you know, ambushing contingents of Norman knights and things like this and terrorizing it. So, yeah, I'm getting into my alternate history of what I would have done had I been at Ely.
Well, you say that, but that is, I think, sort of on some level what happened, at least for a certain period of time. So when Lanfranc is in a bit later, in like the mid 1070s, they pass a law that says if anyone murders a Norman, if their lord, their master, their Anglo-Saxon master or whatever, is legally obliged to find them and turn them in to the Norman authorities. And if you don't, it's a massive, massive fine. And if you refuse to pay that fine, then their crime is on you now. So a type of collective punishment.
This was clearly a problem for the Normans.
Well, that's the thing. What you can infer from that is, oh, so people are murdering Normans all the time. Like, all the time.
You look quite excited about that. Well,
but, you know, it's funny what you can infer from things, isn't it?
Well, because, you wouldn't need it if it wasn't happening.
Exactly. It's one account, just a quick aside, where Lanfranc was supposed to have actually interrogated someone himself, an Anglo-Saxon, who had been loyal to one of the old Anglo-Saxon abbots. And apparently in the cross-examination, if you want a better word, he says, would you kill on behalf of your abbot if your abbot instructed you to kill someone, regardless of who it was? Would you do it? And the man apparently was like, yes, of course I would, of course. It's not what Lanfranc and the Normans want to hear, is it, really? Because they're like, oh, right, yeah, no, we can't trust Englishmen.
No.
It's not to slit our throats in our sleep. Oh. Well, what do you expect if you conquer a land?
Who invited you?
Yeah. You feel free to...
Yeah. This is why I got no particular sympathy for the Russians. And like, I saw a bunch of posts, the Ukrainians are doing horrible things to Russians. It's like, okay, don't invade. You know? I don't care about either side, but I've got no particular sympathy. Oh, no, you know.
Yeah, you know, if you invade someone else's country...
Yeah, you get what you deserve.
What do you expect, really? If they're a proud people.
Yeah. It's the same with, the British in Afghanistan. It's like, you know, if you go down in Afghanistan, you're going to get chopped up. It's like, well, yeah. I don't blame them.
Yeah.
I'd do the same in their position.
Yeah. Just trying to give them some electricity and plumbing, but...
No, they don't need it.
They don't want it.
No, they don't want it, and they don't need it. They never have, and they never will. Become quite anti-imperialist as I grow older.
So after the rebellion at Ely, it does beg the question, where did that come from? Because from the Norman point of view, it sort of come out of nowhere. He thought everything was sort of settling down, especially after the harrowing of the North. And suddenly, sort of kind of out of nowhere, again from his perspective, oh, there's this big Earl's Rebellion and that some of them have escaped. So the question is, who really organised it? Where did it come from? Where are all the people like Edgar the Atheling that have escaped? Where have they gone to? They quite quickly realised Scotland.
Right.
So he goes up to Scotland in 1072, William the Conqueror invades Scotland.
Yep.
Which hasn't been done since Athelstan. People remember our Athelstan. So it's not a common thing in later centuries. We're forever invading Scotland. They're forever invading down into Durham and York.
In the coming millennium,
yeah. But at this point, it was very, well, it's only been done once before. Yeah. And then not massively thoroughly. It's not like sweeping out the Highlands.
No, then it was just about submission.
Right. You know, Athelstan went up there and said, you're bending the knee now, right? And
just have to win one battle and then that's it. You know, we're not here to take over. Just want you to accept that, you know, we're in charge.
So that King Malcolm had married a Margaret who was the sister of Edgar the Atheling. So that sort of thing is worrying from William's point of view,
I can see why William would be bothered by that. Because, I mean, if a few dominoes fell in the right way, then Edgar the Atheling could end up as King of Scotland.
Right.
You know, if you know, things worked out in a weird way, which sometimes it does.
And then the whole of Albion, the whole of Britain might declare for him. So,
It's
a worry to William.
Oh, yeah, I can see it, yeah.
And the fact that Malcolm would even tentatively, even briefly, give the Atheling and various other of the rebels sort of a safe haven, that's still like, what are you doing? A few years ago, you bent the knee and gave me promises and oaths and all sorts of things. What are you doing? So it seems like it wasn't able to be resolved by just letters and things.
Yeah.
William leads an army in Scotland. Now, we're told, we've got very, very few details about this, literally a few lines here and there. But modern historians say it must have been big, though. It must have been one of William's sort of one of his greatest campaigns because it was quite big and technically, logistically, very difficult. He's a long way from the south, from London.
From London, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, well, so it's all like 500 miles.
Yeah, his supply lines and things, they're all sort of at breaking limit, are very, very stretched. But he seems to have thoroughly done it, though.
Wow.
Just completely thoroughly. Yeah. He's good at his job. He knows his business.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.